My name is Jerry Diamond, and I'm from Kalamazoo, Michigan. I am a part of a small Christian community there that is known as the Shalom Community. We chose the name Shalom 8 years ago when we began the community because we began to discover what that word meant, and we were going along and not having a name, and we decided that a church has to have a name. And the name Shalom had such immense dimensions and such rich connotations of things that we were interested in as a people that we just thought that we could never explore all the dimensions of this name. So our name, Shalom, which means, well, peace, it means to be unbroken, it means health, it means harmony, it has implications for social justice, it has implications for our relationship with the environment and all of God's creation. All of those things can be caught up in the biblical concept. We have a name that it's a big room that we can walk around in and explore for the rest of our lives and never end our exploration. I guess you might suspect that I have an interest in peacemaking and those kinds of issues because I belong to a church that means peace. The name of our church constantly is calling me to the meaning of what it is to be a Christian. I want to begin by saying just a couple personal things to set the stage for what I have to say. I have realized I have so many things I want to say that I'm going to run out of time to say them. I may leave a lot of things out. I'll put a warning out ahead of time. There are lots of things that I won't say, that will be left unsaid, that I just, we can't fit them all in. But perhaps if we can have a conversation about these things later, we can bring up some of the things that are left unsaid. The personal confession, I guess, that I'd like to make would go something like this. I believe in my heart that the gospel, the Christian way, that is the way of that I would consider to be spiritual life as a Christian, is nonviolent. It is of the essence of nonviolent. Of the essence of the faith. It is essentially a commitment to a cross, a way of a cross, a nonviolent cross. And I've come to believe that, and I haven't always believed that. And sometimes I wish that I didn't believe it. I wish I could go back somehow where I could justify more easily some kinds of violence. I struggle with that, and what I guess I want to put a warning out to you is what I'm going to do is, in a sense, try to call you to this faith. I confess it. I'm going to sense present a gospel that I believe in, and in a sense, if you don't agree with it, or if you feel strongly that some kinds of violence are necessary and good, I have an ulterior motive that I'll make open to you, that I intend to, what I'm trying to do is to wean you away from that point of view. I'm saying these things in a sense from my own perspective is that you too might have this faith. I don't want that to sound arrogant. I am a violent person, and you are too. I know it. I know deep violence is within me. I have violent fantasies. I have violent words. I have violent outbursts. I tend to think of ways to solve problems very often that are violent. I am not saying that I am a nonviolent person. I have not always held the belief, though, that the Christian faith is one of essentially nonviolence. I would say it's probably not more than about 10 years ago, or a little more than maybe 12 years ago, that I really got spun around. That's a good story how I began to get spun around, but I can't tell. It would take a long time. But it involved an encounter with Clarence Jordan. And if any of you know who Clarence Jordan and the Koinonia Farm is, you kind of know what I mean. I am on the road, I feel, in this way, walking in this way, and I'm a long way from home yet. I'm not there. But I do feel that that's the Christian way of walking. We are Well, one of the passages, may not quote it exactly right, is that we are to grow up in Christ to full maturity, to full stature, to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. That's where we're going. And I don't have any, I just cannot see Jesus as engaging in violence. And if I'm growing up into that, then I'm going in that direction one way or the other. One thing that began to spin me around about this is very trite, and many of the things that have begun to turn me a little bit away from violence have been simple, oversimplified things. One was a poster I saw one time. This was way long before I met Clarence Jordan. And the poster simply had a figure of Jesus in the middle of it. It looked like a Sunday school picture of Jesus with the long robes and just no question about who he was. And all around him in the poster were symbols of warfare and violence. Bombs, rockets, bazookas, swords, tanks, all that kind of stuff. And the caption on the poster was, "Does he, or would he, or wouldn't he?" And I looked at that poster and I had never really thought about that much before. He wouldn't. But then I had to somehow try to make that fit with my understanding of the faith, where I'm a kid who could still remember World War II. I wasn't in it. I was 9 years old when it ended, but my church and all the inputs I had were, yes, of course you fight with weapons to put down evil and so forth in the world, and that's the way it is, and that's right. There are many ways in which I could attempt to begin this, and this may not be a good way, but it's the way I've chosen. I'm going to give it a shot anyhow. Spirituality now is important to me because I got into nonviolent thing more from a practical standpoint and thinking about it in a more logical fashion, become more interested in prayer and in my spiritual growth, my inward spiritual growth, which led me to Thomas Merton. And I want to read to you just a couple of lines from Thomas Merton to set this up for how I want to talk about it. in a something, Thomas Merton, incidentally, if you don't know, is a monk. He died in 1968, and he's, I would say, one of the towering figures of spirituality of the 20th century. And if you don't know about him, you will probably at some point, and people for many centuries, I think, will know about him. So Nietzsche's declaration that God is dead is one that is now taken up, not without seriousness, by the prophets of the most, quote, progressive tendencies in Western religion, which now seems, in some quarters, eager to prove its sincerity in the eyes of a godless society by an act of spiritual self-destruction. Meanwhile, artists, poets, and others who might be expected to have some concern with the inner life of man are declaring that the reason why God has ceased to be present, and it's a little sexist language, but Merton didn't think about that too much, ceased to be present to man, and therefore dead, is that man has ceased to be present to himself. And that's what I was trying to stress all last week. I don't know how many people who were there caught it, but being present to ourselves, man has ceased to be present to himself, and that consequently the true significance of the statement God is dead is really that man is dead. The obvious fact of man's material agitation and external frenzy serves only to emphasize his lack of spiritual life. Since it is by symbolism that man is spiritually and consciously in contact with his own deepest self, with other men and with God, then both the death of God and the death of man are to be accounted for by the fact that symbolism is dead. Symbolism is dead. We're living in an age of the death of symbols, the death, in a sense, I'll say a minute later here, of language. I think that Dietrich Bonhoeffer, one of our German Lutheran theologians, lived a crucial and agonizing question. And that question, I would say, would be something like the cultural form of Christianity that we know in the West is in crisis. Bonhoeffer is living through a deep anxiety and wrestling in torment with the question about the culture that is decaying and the Christianity that's tied to that culture. A Christianity which is tied in the Western society to a culture which is defunct. And so I think, I don't know a lot about Dietrich Bonhoeffer. I wouldn't presume even to be able to put together a whole lot of sentences about him, but I get this much sense from him, that Bonhoeffer kind of embodied a question. It's not an intellectual question, but it was a gut question that tormented Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And in some of his letters, in 1928, he wrote a letter to his grandmother and expressed in that letter a desire to go to India. To seek out, because he sensed of the poverty of the culture in which he was, that maybe in the East he would find something which would help him. He sensed in a letter he wrote in 1934 that Christianity, Western cultural Christianity, is approaching its end. And also in 1934 he wrote in a letter, of course, Christianity did come from the East originally, but it has been so westernized and so permeated by civilized thought that as we can now see it, it is almost lost to us. Well, I guess the question I want to set in nonviolence is this question of the loss of language, the meaning of symbols. What has happened to the meaning of symbols? One story I want to tell you about Clarence Jordan, it won't take very long. One time Clarence said he was... this is down south, and he went to visit another preacher that he knew that had a big church, and they were just purchased a cross that they were setting on top of the steeple of their church, and then this other preacher said to Clarence Jordan, sort of with a gleam in his eye, that this is a beautiful thing. It only cost us $10,000, and Clarence Jordan said, "Well, shame on you! You got gypped." Because the time was when Christians could have those for free. That's what I mean by the loss. What in the world does that symbol mean? What the symbols, for example, of Christmas, which are coming up, God so loves my family, or my friends, or my clan, or God so loves the world. The symbol of Easter, John Schramm in his Bible study last week talked about Easter is yes to Good Friday. Good Friday and the suffering nonviolent cross is the gospel. I mean, Easter is not something which says, Jesus got beat on Good Friday, but I'm going to make him win on Easter Sunday. That Easter is yes to Good Friday. That's what it says yes to. And all these language, these words, love, faith, hope, suffering, joy, what do these symbols mean? Thomas Merton, in one of his articles, said something like this. He points out, the Christian faith is lived in such a schizophrenic way that it's a wonder that a person can be at the same time a Christian and sane. That is, we've got, on the one hand, the words of the gospel, which seem to me pretty clear. On the other hand, the cultural form in which it comes and the way we try to live it out in our Western society, and Merton wrestled with that question and embodied that question in his own being. How can we even live it out and be sane? Now, you may not think it's that bad. You may not think the situation with our Christian faith and spirituality is that bad, but two towering theologians, spiritual giants of the 20th century, did feel it was that bad, and I'm just wondering whether we can listen to them. So Thomas Merton, for example, placed nonviolence in the context of the breakdown of language. It doesn't mean anything anymore. We use the words love, and love our neighbor as ourselves, and all this kind of the language, but where's the content? So he puts nonviolence in the context of the breakdown of language and symbols. There's no meaning to them anymore. And I'll give you an example of that. I think I can still remember vividly one of the speeches of Richard Nixon, at which he ended with the words, "Let there be peace on earth, and let it begin with me." And this was during the Vietnam War, and when they're secretly escalating it and dropping bombs in Cambodia. I mean, what does it mean, let there be peace on earth, and let it begin with me? Can we even speak at all? Should we even use words? I mean, I'm using a lot of words now, but maybe the best thing we could do for a long time is just be silent, just silent meditation for maybe months and maybe a year. Silence and suffering love. For example, language of salvation. Save, that's a Christian word, isn't it? I mean, save. And you all know the famous line from the Vietnam War, we had to destroy the village in order to save it. What happens to theological language, scriptural language, biblical language, spiritual language, a word like save, when it can be used in the context of wiping out a village to save it? I've thought about military language too. Military language has appropriated Christian language, Christian words, to a remarkable degree. I'll give you just a couple examples of them. Military service. I've been in the military service. Service, servanthood, is a rich Christian word, okay? And as I understand it, has nothing to do with killing at all. Or mission. Mission is a word that has to do with our faith. What does it do when you say we had to go on a search and destroy mission? See what I mean by the language becoming empty? Search and destroy mission. There's two deeply spiritual words. Search and you will find. Knock and it will be opened unto you. Search and destroy mission? I mean, you see, it's the poverty, the degradation of the language, and you, we could add more of these. Coke adds life. I mean, what more rich word from John's gospel than life? Our culture, this is the Pepsi generation. Jesus sometimes said this is the perverse generation. Or words like security or freedom. Freedom. I wouldn't want to get into a debate about this one, but the Christian concept of freedom has nothing to do with the cultural forms that we talk about freedom. I'm not saying that our relative ability to do things in this country vis-a-vis some other countries is bad, but that's not what Christian freedom is about. I mean, you can be in the bottom of the deepest pit jail cell and be more free than somebody walking down Madison Avenue. I mean, I know that's true. And we have notions of freedom that are radically unbiblical. Jesus says, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." And nonviolence is connected with truth. And that's what it's about. Let me read you something else from Thomas Merton that I think might begin to say some of this. Nonviolence is not for power, but for truth. It is not pragmatic, but prophetic. It is not aimed at immediate political results, but at the manifestation of fundamental and crucially important truth. Nonviolence is not primarily the language of efficacy, but the language of kairos. It does not say, "We shall overcome," so much as, "This is the day of the Lord, and whatever may happen to us, he shall overcome." People begin to imagine... As people begin to imagine, to say only force works is to discredit nonviolence. This half-truth that only force works may turn out to be one of the most dangerous illusions of our time. It may do more than anything else to promote an irresponsible and meaningless use of force that will only consolidate the power of police states. Never was it more necessary to understand the importance of genuine nonviolence as a power for real change, because it is aimed not so much at revolution as at conversion. Unfortunately, and this again would have to do with language, mere words about peace, love, civilization have completely lost all power to change anything. I should smile. I hate to be so intense, but I feel strongly about this. Words like, I don't particularly like the word pacifism, and I'm not using the word pacifist. Someone may say I'm a pacifist, but I don't think I want to call myself that, really. I don't like isms of any kind. I think as soon as I hear an ism on the end of the word, I get suspicious. Whether it's pacifism or militarism or capitalism or Marxism or Lutheranism or Catholicism, all these isms, my antennae go up if I hear an ism. So I don't know if, I'm not talking about pacifism, but nonviolence and maybe pacifism are involved in this question of language. And so let me get to say it kind of in one sentence, and I'll bring up the name Gandhi. Gandhi, in our century, has given us some paradigms of working out nonviolence in actual social, on the dusty street situations. I'm astounded at how many people, A, haven't even heard of Gandhi. I meet a lot of people who've never heard of Gandhi. And if they have read nothing whatsoever or don't really know what he's all about. In a sense, for Gandhi, nonviolence is a kind of language. It is a way of speaking, but through action. It is not talking about loving your enemy. It is the act itself which is the language. It is the only language, perhaps, that has any meaning. Gandhi didn't go around and just generally love Indians. But the act of nonviolence itself is a language. I think the meaning of the word cross would be restored in a big hurry to us if we were in imminent danger of being nailed to one. Then we would really begin to understand, perhaps, what it's all about. The meaning of the gospel also might be radically restored. So nonviolence as a way of life, as a way of relating, is true communication on a human level. When language has been emptied of its meaning through misuse and through corruption. Nonviolence is meant to convey and defend truth, not by just words, but by acts. To convey and defend truth that has been obscured and defiled through religious and political double talk. Now let me say, I'll say it as strongly as I can, so I maybe give you something to really react to. Maybe make some people very angry with me. We're talking here this summer at the Village on the politics of hope. There is no hope in violence. I'll just say that categorically, and then if you want to argue with me about it, you can. There is no hope in violence. I'm saying that as an article of my faith. In violence, there may be optimism. We win this war and things are going to get better. There may be expediency. There may be a temporary suppression of this or that kind of thing, but no hope. Violence is the inevitable companion, not of truth, God, security, justice, but violence is the inevitable companion of the fall. It is a companion of fallenness, not God, not truth, not holy crusades and justice and all those things, but the fall. Now that's not, I throw this out again and try to cover my rear end a little bit here. That's not to say that God cannot bring some good out of evil. That is to say, we are not to go out and do evil so that God's goodness can look even better, you know. Violence is in me and it's in you. It's in our children. It's in our state. We are all kids of Adam. That's what it comes down to. And we can't think our way out of it. I don't believe that's possible. What it requires, I believe, is conversion. What I'm doing is, if you're all converted, we ought to just go up and have a cup of coffee. But if you're not, it calls for the power of the Spirit of God to change us somehow inside. I am not going to work my way out of being a violent person. I am going to go inside of myself and find out the absolute poverty of my love. And let the Spirit of God change that and come into me. The cross is the astounding message, I think, of nonviolent suffering love. What the cross says to me is, when I look at it, is God is like that. That is the way. I think it was A.J. Musty that said something like this, talking about the United States and the Soviet Union somehow getting together, and there are some people who are in the peace movement stuff who feel this way, and working things out so we'll have a happy world. A.J. Musty said that an unrepentant and essentially unbelieving nation, and he's talking about the United States, unrepentant and unbelieving nation will, on the basis of self-interest, work out an agreement with an unrepentant and avowedly unbelieving communist regime, work out an agreement that will make peace. That's optimistic. That is not hope, though. That is not Christian hope. And I think that peace movement people who are deluding themselves think that that's really going to bring some kind of ultimate peace. Or let me say the schizophrenia in a different way. I think if you got up into a pulpit and you preached a sermon and you said that doing good for people, feeding people, contributing to the hunger funds, helping starving children, bringing justice into third world countries, helping with the food shortage in the world, doing something about the health problems, and that see that everybody in the world has got some at least basic health care and adequate housing and shelter and so forth. That's the Christian way of life, and it would be a giant step toward peace. Everybody, I think, in your congregation would say, ah, that's right. That's what it's all about. At the same time, if you poll those people, there is a strong sense that the U.S. must stockpile H-bombs and missiles to keep the godless communists from crushing the Christian churches. Now, that's us double-minded. I'd like to run through five kind of basic principles that I think that I see in the New Testament that are not marginal elements in the New Testament, but central elements in the New Testament, which if you deny them, you're virtually denying the New Testament, that I think that do point us toward nonviolence and in the relationship to warfare, for example, that do not condone war. These are in a book called The New Testament Basis of Peacemaking. Now, this is by Richard McSorley. He's a Catholic priest. It's a very simple book to read. You sit down and read this book in an hour or two, and then you may just take McSorley to the mat and wrestle with him for a long time, but you got to at least wrestle with him. In this book, he said, instead of just pulling out some proof passage texts, he, at the beginning, just gives us some general overall principles and themes. The first one is love. Such things in the New Testament that tell us we are to love our neighbor as ourselves, and that this love in the New Testament is an all-embracing, Catholic, that is universal, love to include our enemies, and to pray for those who persecute us, and so forth. That my attitude, Christ is calling me to have an attitude that is not determined by what that person out there does to me. I am to love that one, even though that one doesn't love me or is even trying to hurt me. Now notice that it's not a do-nothing. The ethic of love in the New Testament isn't do-nothing. It's okay to kill my enemy as long as I don't hate him. I mean, the gospel asks much more than that. It doesn't just ask us for the absence of hate. It asks for positive, active love, even toward the enemy. And we are to do this, the New Testament, I believe, tells us, not so that the other one will love me back, but so that we might be children of our Heavenly Father, Mother, God. That's the so that. No reciprocity. We are to love the Soviets, for example, not because they love us or might become to love us, but because God loves us. This premise of universal love that is, I think, a part of the ethic of the gospel of Jesus Christ rules out killing even to protect others. We're going to kill these people over here to defend these people over there. That, I don't think, has any basis, really, in the gospel. It's not just the absence of hate, but a positive love. Moving along quickly on the other four points, the whole concept in the New Testament that God is our Father, Mother, God. We are all God's children. All. There is only one God, and we and if our country's policy, even, or any regime's policy, cannot be reconciled with this, then I can't accept the policy. I mean, that's kind of what it comes down to. So perhaps we'll find ourselves at some real serious odds with the government, whatever government, wherever we live. To deny that we are brothers, all brothers and sisters, is a kind of implicit atheism, because it denies God's existence as the common source of all of our being, all. Jesus doesn't say, as you did it unto one of the least of these, it's like you did it to me. He says, you did it to me. I'll push that far. So that a denial of that kind of love is also, in a sense, an implicit denial of the incarnation. Okay, the third point that McSorley says generally in the New Testament is the value, the worth of the human person. That Christ's death for persons is a measure of God's love and also a measure of each person's value in God's eyes. So that violence just depersonalized that other one. The fourth is ends and means. That was one that Gandhi himself used a great deal. The ends justify the means, saying that the end is implicit in the means. That's very clearly true in the gospel. The gospel teaches that the ends and the means are compatible. In fact, even convertible. The end is union with God. The means is love of God and others. Love is union with God. Union with God is love. In violence, whenever we're engaging in violence, the ends and the means are contradictory. So that saving is done by killing. You can do that with violence. With Jesus and his teaching and his life, the ends and the means that he's using to achieve those ends are always absolutely consistent. They are always compatible. And Jesus puts it like this, you shall know them by their fruits. That's another way of looking at it. Do the fruits of war equal the fruits of the gospel? The gospel asks us to take up a cross, upon ourselves. Violence, whatever form, whether it's a little bitty personal violence over here or big social violence, asks us to lay suffering on somebody else. And the fifth example McSorley calls forth is Jesus himself. And you could summarize that with the poster. Would he or wouldn't he? He wouldn't, I don't think. Jesus' method is accepting the cross, accepting suffering love, not inflicting it on others. Jesus is the living example of good news, of hope, that his whole life, his whole way, his way of making peace is through the cross and redemptive love. And I believe that I and you are called to walk that way. That's what it comes down to. I could say some other things about violence, and particularly in the context of war, but even in a personal context, as a form of idolatry. Really a form of idolatry. Institutionalized violence is worshiping a false god. Gordon Cosby says, where do I let down my full weight? That's my God. Or is your trust? I think that since the time of Constantine, when violence was accepted basically as a legitimate means, we've been in a wilderness about this as Christians, with the exception of a consistent witness down through that time of some Christians who continue to hold up the nonviolent cross as the way of Jesus. I think as we delve deeper into ourselves and into spiritual depth, it leads us to this truth. I think the world is, I don't know that many people would really argue this, the world is on a brink of violent destruction. It's quite possible. And followers of Jesus the Christ, I think, know the mystery of God's peace. We know what the mystery is, and we know the means for achieving it. And followers of Jesus, the Messiah, are all over. They are in every nation. And I think we are called now to be a prophetic witness where we are. You see, in theory, we may accept nonviolence. We may accept, in theory, the way of the cross. But I think what we find is that our concrete enemy is always a special case. Nonviolence really would work. It really worked, you know, it would work with Gandhi because, well, the British, they were a little nicer than the Russians are. Or, I mean, our reason for using violence is always kind of a special case. As I kind of view my spiritual growth and my spiritual life and in the context of nonviolence, it's not a political tactic. It is not just a different way to get what I want. That's a nonviolence of weakness. It's a way of life that is essentially exposing the truth, and we are called to walk that way or some other way, but we need to choose which way. Well, I'll go back just for a second, and then I'll stop talking to Bonhoeffer and Merton. Our culture has sucked all the life out of the language. Nonviolence needs to be placed in that context, I think, because it is language. It is a way of communicating in some meaningful way. The opportunity, I believe, before Christians on this planet right now is enormous. And I would ask the question, like, what are we waiting for? So the theme of the village this summer is not the politics of hope. The theme of the village this summer is living the politics of hope. And I put the emphasis now on the first word, living the politics of hope. Well, I don't think I'm telling tales on John. He said to me this afternoon, village is really a place of words. And I said, yeah, John, I noticed that. There's a lot of words. We're just really buried in language. And here I am doing all this talking and adding to it. And I noticed a lot of it's up here in myself as well as in others that I hear speaking. That's why I'm emphasizing in the spirituality thing is going inside. You're not going to get the government out there to solve the problem or somebody else to solve the problem, but it needs to get into our guts. And living the politics of hope, there are shining examples in our own time. I mean, I could go back over all the centuries for examples, but in our own time, names that came to my mind as I was putting this down on paper today would be Gandhi, Martin Luther King, Thomas Merton, Clarence Jordan, Jim Douglas, Mother Teresa, Albert Schweitzer, Vinoba, Dom Helder Camara, Dorothy Day, Cesar Chavez, Danilo Dolci, Franz Jägerstätter. I mean, the names go on and on. If you don't know all those names, just look them up. You'll find something about them. And many, many, many more are in our own century. So I think I'll stop.